Trust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman produces. I'm John Williams. Thanks for joining us today. We start with Mike Miller. We've got a lot of ground to cover, and we said we'll start with some good news and bad news. Mike is the Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University and joins us frequently. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you.
What's the good news?
Well, the good news is what has been going on now for some time, and that's housing. We have a bunch of people whose jobs have not been dramatically affected, and now with their incomes relatively stable and the housing market such that they can get a loan at unbelievably low interest rates, people are buying, and we have the housing market booming. We have the lowest inventory of homes for sale in something like 14 years, which is hard to believe. And sales are also at multi-year highs. So those who still have the means are taking advantage of the Fed's low interest rate policy and making changes in their home situation.
That's nice.
Now, housing.
Go ahead and finish that thought, sir.
I was going to say housing is one of those cyclical industries. Usually housing goes down when the economy goes down and goes up when the economy goes up. So it is almost counter-cyclical in this case because, you know, the economy is still a good deal of struggling going on. And there's parts of the economy, of course, people who have lost their job and they're having trouble. There's a housing bad market, and that is people who can't pay their rent. And the number of evictions that could be coming up over the next 3 or 4 months are kind of staggering. And I know that the numbers are not real high, but percentage of the market compared to historical averages, the number of people who could be evicted is very troublesome.
Back to the good news for just a moment. That also gives people access to capital, to cash, right? If the value of your home has gone up and the interest rates are low, a lot of people suddenly have money to spend that did not anticipate that, right?
That's right. And they can use that money on, you would hope that they would use it not on lotto tickets and travel, but more on things like improving their home or education and so forth. But of course, that's the decision of the people with the money. But it does free up, you can think of a house as an investment, though I think of it more as a consumption good. And if you want, you can, as its value rises, you can tap into that sort of saving and then use that money to buy things that you need.
Let's go back to the bad news equation, part of the equation, and that is the labor market. Is the labor market going to go as COVID goes? There are just going to be fewer jobs as long as we have a second wave?
It sure seems that way. And, of course, just like we've had during the main part of the pandemic, some of us are not affected. Others are dramatically affected. And with the continued shutdowns that are aimed at entertainment and hospitality, you add another piece. I work at a university, and students, where else can they go? They seem to be willing to continue to go to school, and they're doing it online. But the industries that are going to get hurt, of course, again, are going to be restaurants, entertainment, and hospitality. And there could be a wave of layoffs. So we're seeing that the number of job postings and changes in the number of jobs being offered and so forth is declining. And that tells us that while the unemployment rate has fallen quite precipitously, which is good, it has fallen a lot since the depths of the pandemic. We're not seeing much help or hope when it comes to the labor market over the next couple of months.
Michael Miller is an associate professor of economics at DePaul. Speaking of students, a hot topic right now is student debt forgiveness. The new Biden administration might be primed to do that. And there's push from the liberal wings of the Democratic Party to be very aggressive there. What's your take on the wisdom of that, Michael? Very popular topic right now is student debt cancellation. In fact, we'll be spending a little more time on this tomorrow on my 9 to noon show. What's your thought about chopping $10,000 or $50,000 off the debt?
I'll tell you, we know that the debt has really changed the lives of people in the generation who borrowed the money. Because they carry that large debt, they have had trouble getting mortgages and starting families and so forth. It is an issue that we have to face. What we find, though, is if you do it, there's an equity question, and I'm not the expert on that, but of course, we do know that most of the benefit would go to those in the upper half of the income distribution. It wouldn't go to the people on the bottom, because a lot of people on the bottom don't go to college, but they do pay taxes. They would have to pay to help cover this $1.5 trillion worth of debt. What a lot of people don't understand about it is, let's say, just for the sake of argument, that the federal government decides to forgive the entire $1.5 trillion worth of debt. It doesn't free up $1.5 trillion. Of course, it costs $1.5 trillion. But for the average family, their monthly payment for their student loan might be $200 or $300. That's what it frees up. Now, that's not nothing. But the effect upon the economy immediately would be somewhat limited. So if you said to me, I have $1 trillion that you can spend now, should we forgive these loans or should we use it in another way? And if what you want is stimulus to get us through the rest of this pandemic until the spring, I hope, when the vaccines take hold and so forth, it seems like dollars to the states have the bigger multiplier. And a very targeted unemployment process where the people who are working and, say, losing their jobs in hospitality or whatever, that we get them through the rough times, that the spending of the money that they are given will be much more substantial and will make the economy grow more than if we simply forgive some debt.
Is it possible to know what the people who would get student debt forgiveness will do with that extra money now that they have it in their pocket?
You know, we can only guess, because now we do know that when something is permanent, we call this a permanent change because the debt's gone forever, they can make fundamental changes in their spending. So they could use that $200 or $300 to add on to other money they have to maybe begin to buy a home or start a family. So that would be good. But we've never been here before. We're dealing with a particular generation and a particular kind of debt that all we would be doing is making guesses. And sometimes those guesses are right. And, you know, in economics, oftentimes those guesses are wrong.
Well, they're Americans. I would imagine they would spend it. Is there no precedent for this? That's kind of funny and kind of not. But is there no precedent for this? We do this for corporations. We've done this before,
yes.
Right?
Well, we've done it, and we do it for other countries as well, you know, that other countries owe us money and we simply have debt forgiveness. But to do it for a group of consumers, and, you know, you almost have to bring up the fairness question. We know that people who make the highest incomes are people who go to college. We know there's a big difference on average.
Their parents do. I mean, these young people that graduate with student debt, they're not making a lot of money, right?
No, that's one of the problems. In a lot of the cases, what they have done is they've taken loans and they're not finding jobs which generate sufficient income to both be living their lives and paying their rent and starting a family and paying off their student loans. Now, students who go into very productive and very lucrative majors, maybe petroleum engineering or even accountancy and so forth, you know, they will make enough money to make their payments. And, so there's, you know, so much of when you provide economic assistance from the government to the people, one of the big words you always look for is targeted, to make sure that the money goes to the people in need in terms of an income redistribution, but also to the people who will spend the money, because that will have that stimulative effect upon the economy. And I think it would take some time to figure out exactly how that money should get into the hands of those students. You know, the idea, I kind of like the idea, if we're going to have one, maybe the first $10,000, you know, you're still on the hook for if you borrowed a lot and since you did borrow and you got the benefit of the degree, you should be paying for this, mm-hmm. for this loan, but maybe to get them, you know, over this rough time. I know some have suggested that what they simply do is continue the idea of deferring payments, but not charging interest. And that will get us through the pandemic, and then we can look at it with with a more structured thought process to come up with the best policy.
With forbearance, that's what some people are doing. That is,
yes,
they're not paying interest,
exactly.
They're paying down the principal, and that's been working dandy. What you're saying also dovetails, I presume, with what you also feel about stimulus then. Rather than giving everybody $1,200, let's find people who are working at some targeted income threshold and give them an unemployment supplement.
That's correct. And certainly the pandemic, of course, has been very uneven in terms of who it affects. It hasn't affected people like you and me. It has affected people,
yeah,
in many cases, women and minorities who work in a lot of these industries which have been affected, such as hospitality and so forth. And any policy then that deals with such problems really does need to be targeted.
We've always had inequities in this country, but boy, have they ever been more glaring, more bare than they are right now.
Yeah, you know, and what makes it even more, I don't want to say disturbing, but maybe that is the right word. You know, this was all brought upon completely by surprise. So, I mean, we've had pandemics before, but the one big difference is we've not responded the same way. As far as I know, this is the very first time that the government at various levels has decided what we need to do is shut down economic activity. And when the government, in a sense, is behind that, then we have a completely different distributional problem. The government is, in a sense, causing the problem. And it's, as I've said before, it's part of their job then to make whole the people that are hurt by that particular action, that the government made these changes.
Just one more question. Are there any other government,
sure,
programs that you'd like to see the Biden administration maintain or get rid of? We mentioned forbearance. What about the program to help people with their rent, or their mortgage payments for landlords and,
yeah,
for tenants?
Yeah, I think they're going to have to do something about that. Otherwise, we're going to have, I think the word people often use is we're going to go off a cliff come around the time of January. You know, a lot of people have been able to make it because they haven't had to pay their rent. But at the same time, of course, that hurts the landlord. The landlord needs that money then to pay his or her own bills and meet the taxes on the land and so forth. So I would like them to work on that housing question and some kind of housing assistance, which would keep people from the great disruption, which is both an economic disruption as well as a social disruption, of when you're thrown out of your own home.
I'm going to keep you for just one more topic, and that is the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID vaccine. We have three of them now. Hooray, right? Do you have any,
yeah,
thoughts about the rollout of these?
You know, again, boy, it seems like that the word of the day is targeted. I think it clearly has to go to the people on the front lines in terms of health care, because they're already putting their lives on the line to serve us. And then to try to get the people who are most vulnerable in terms of age or comorbidities and so forth, things that would, I did observe, and I'm not an expert in this field at all, but I guess some of them can be actually transported in a normal refrigerator, and another one needs something like 70 below zero to be,
right,
transported.
Sure.
So it seems to me that that presents an issue. And, you know, we also face another issue. We're not a sole country in the world. Just think of all the other people in the world that have a need for these same doses. So a decision has to kind of be made. Does the dollar talk and those with the money get to buy the doses, or do we find some kind of way to allocate the vaccine to people around the world, going and targeting it first and then making it generally available to the public, the public of the United States? Those are going to be some really hard decisions, and I'm glad I don't have to make them.
Well, I'll make the one on behalf of the United States. That is, it would seem to me like for the 330 million of us, it has to be the same price for everybody, and I think that has to be free, and I believe that's the plan.
I believe that is the plan. I think it's somewhere like I think the companies have decided they're not going to try to make a profit off this, but it was very expensive to create these vaccines. So even if they just recoup their costs, we're probably still talking around $30 per dose. And somebody has to come up with that money, and it seems to me that the federal government is one of those places that this is one of those uses of running a deficit that is in the
yeah,
fundamentally sound interest of the United States.
Well, I don't know that this observation is all that useful, but they're going to make money off of this. I mean, are you kidding,
yeah,
me? Even if Pfizer covers their cost, A, you got $2 billion there, and B,
that's
I
right,
kind of, I'm I've been around long enough to think somebody's probably going to find a way to make a nickel off of this thing.
I think that's true. And one other thing that could happen here is I know a lot of people want to go after Big Pharma because they think that they're making too much money and they want to regulate their prices. This is one of those places where they say, see, if I'm too regulated, I won't be able to do these kinds of things. So it could be that they're thinking long run, that they're going to be in a better position by appearing to sell everything at cost. And but, you know, to an economist, part of the cost is what we call normal profit, what you would get as a normal rate of return. So built into that price could be something we call a normal profit, well, you know, a couple percent return on your investment.
Mr. Economist, isn't this also an example of why the other pill costs $200? I mean, these are fantastically expensive things to do, and that money comes from somewhere, usually.
That's correct. That is exactly the case. And, you know, it costs so very little to create a dose in terms of once you have the technology already done. What they have to do is they have to recoup all those investment costs that they made. And that's why economists are very wary of the idea of setting the price of prescription drugs and trying to keep them artificially low, because if companies cannot recoup their investments, they're not going to bother investing. And so controlling prices could have a long-run negative effect on the development of new drugs over time. So maybe that's why I'm saying that maybe this is where these companies will say, okay, for this one, I can get some good PR by being very careful and pricing it such a way that I don't appear to be making a profit, but in the long run, I'm going to want you to take care of me. And, you know, that just might be how it works out.
Always a pleasure, Michael Miller. Thanks for joining us today, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University.
That was great, John. Thank you.
It's our pleasure. Continue on the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN with Catherine Davis. She joins us frequently here on The Lunch, Associate Editor at Chicago Inno. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. How's it going?
Actually, pretty good. And a short work week for me, 3 days. Taking Toiki day off, so hooray for that. In fact, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the idea of a short work week. You wrote a story about how the office world will change for people now and maybe in the indefinite future, and I had never thought about this. Some people have managed four-day work weeks, but now that we're living at home, that and a lot of other things have changed, right?
That's right, yeah. So I interviewed a group of Chicago tech companies just on, you know, what their plans are post-pandemic, so, you know, how they're approaching going back into the office and work from home, and like you said, even shortened work weeks. One particular company called Top Step Trader, they're a fintech company here in town, they've been experimenting with a four-day work week since the summer, so essentially employees are expected to work Monday through Thursday for 10 hours each day, so they're still working a 40-hour work week but can enjoy the luxury of three-day weekends. So far, the CEO, Jay Rudman, has told me that, you know, work has largely gone on business as usual. People are still just as productive and are also reporting a better work-life balance.
Just trying to think. I know so many people that are working at home and they're stressed out. They're working a lot. I haven't heard anybody working from home lately reference that they take Fridays or Mondays off. I mean, some people do, but as a result of the company's dictate, like we're you know, work four tens, because people are working five tens, a lot of them as it is. I think that's
right.
A good idea.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Top Step said they did this because they were hearing from their workforce that they were burned out, that they, you know, their mental health was suffering, and the CEO wanted to sort of take steps to address that and, you know, give employees a better sense of work-life balance and, you know, just some more downtime. One extra day in the week can help a lot of people, especially working parents.
Is there anything else that they are talking about in the tech world or otherwise in Chicago about working from home?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of companies actually cancel their office leases, you know, throughout the last 8 months or so. One is obviously a cost-saving factor right now when employees can't go back to the office. But, you know, a lot of these tech CEOs are telling me they don't plan to get those full-time office spaces back. That they want employees to continue working remotely and maybe meet up once a month or every 6 months for an all-hands meeting. But that's something they can do at a WeWork, right? You can rent out a conference room for a few hours once a month, every 6 months, and, you know, still sort of maintain your team mostly remote.
That I don't know what the stocks of those companies are. I know some of them actually struggled early in the pandemic, but you'd think that that would be a very good investment or a very good business model.
Right, absolutely. Popular Pays, they're one of the companies that's going fully remote, has gotten rid of their physical office space, and the CEO told me that they've cut expenses by 15% year over year. Cameo, another local company, they've done the same, getting rid of their office space completely, and with the money they saved, they gave every employee a bonus. Huh. So, you know, there's certainly some financial upsides to getting rid of the office space.
Listen to me. Ha! Bonus. That's interesting. I forgot about Cameo, but I guess they're still out there and doing their thing. They were a lot of fun to talk with and about pre-pandemic. It sort of fell off my radar, but I suppose they're still making personalized videos and audio messages for people, huh?
That's right. And, you know, they've actually really been growing during the pandemic. You know, I think because people are looking for ways to stay connected and give virtual gifts and all these things, you know, people are turning to Cameo for those celebrity shout outs. Cameo has actually hired probably like 30 to 40 people just this year. They have more than 150 employees worldwide.
Can you imagine that? Well, the latest wrinkle for them was that they would sit a celebrity in on your Zoom call. And you could hang with whoever that person is for however much. I don't know how A-level you get for that. That sounds like a lot of work for some of these people that could otherwise say, happy birthday, Catherine. But there is a market for that out there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And especially in a COVID world where a lot of these entertainers can't work the way they used to, right? Like, you know, musicians can't go on tour. You know, actors are, you know, some filming is still happening, but a lot of it has stopped. And so, you know, when they're looking for ways to, you know, supplement their income, I think Cameo becomes a really attractive option.
Somebody told me recently about Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R, I think it is. It's sort of like a TaskRabbit service, but it has a lot to do with writing, video, audio production for people. And so a lot of the agencies are closed or business isn't happening the way it used to. I won't say a lot of agencies are closed. I don't know that, but I do know this. There's a market for amateurs, if you will, who have decent microphones at home to start to produce audio and video for people. And folks are turning it in and making a nickel here and making a nickel there, which I had no idea that marketplace existed.
I've definitely heard of Fiverr. I think they're based out in San Francisco.
I think they are. Chicago's Vital Proteins is a medicine group?
So it's sort of a medical group. The interesting thing, so here's what they do. They basically make collagen peptide products, so like protein bars, beverages, and they promise to replicate the natural collagen found in the body. So, you know, the reason you would take this is, you know, to sort of bolster up the health of your joints and ligaments, as well as improve the strength and appearance of your hair, skin, and nails. And so what's funny is that the founder, you know, I think in an interview a couple years ago, you know, he's like, I thought I was making a healthcare company, but really I've created a beauty company because so many women are attracted to these products, you know, for sort of the physical benefits that it provides with the hair and the skin and the nails.
This is a Chicago-based company. Are these the one that brought on Jennifer Aniston?
That's right, exactly. So just last week, Vital Proteins announced that they brought on Jennifer Aniston as their chief creative officer. And so the idea here is that she's going to have input on future products as well as advertise the brand. And the reason that they got connected to her is because she has been endorsing Vital Proteins products, you know, on her social media accounts and in media appearances for years. She says it's really helped her and that she's noticed a difference in her body, and now she's officially joining the company.
Speaking of this sort of field, medicine or whatever that is, talk to me about Tempus.
Yes, so Tempus is Chicago's most valuable startup. They are in the precision medicine industry, basically making personalized treatment plans for cancer patients. They've raised a ton of money, like $500 million or so, $600 million, valued at $5 billion. And now they're pivoting to address COVID. So they announced last week that they are developing their own COVID-19 test and will be processing patients' swabs and samples at their location here in Chicago.
Hmm. So what does that mean for you and me? Am I going to, I mean, I can get a test now from the county, from my local hospital. They're going to compete with them, or are they going to sell their tests to those places?
They'll be selling their tests to those places, but also collecting the patient samples to test them at their lab.
I suppose there's going to be a market for this indefinitely. I mean, you wonder if maybe we get this thing licked. There won't be a COVID conversation. There won't be a COVID concern in a few years. I suppose that's possible too, huh?
Right, yeah, that's absolutely possible. You know, I'm not exactly sure how Tempus is looking at this in the long term from a business perspective. My, you know, sort of gut feeling here is that they have all of these resources at their disposal and felt they just needed to help what is becoming, like, you know, a really terrible crisis for Americans and the rest of the world.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I suppose they've got the resources to do it, big as they are. Nice to talk to you today, Catherine Davis, Associate Editor, Chicago NO. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, John.
Into the Wintrust business, or into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom we go, and Don Kleppen has an update on the business scene.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. U.S. business activity expanded at the fastest rate in more than 5 years this month, led by the quickest pickup in manufacturing since September 2014. That was showed by a survey today. In an indication the economy keeps making progress at clambering out of the COVID-19 recession, even as infections surge. Uber and Lyft have been awarded a federal contract worth up to $810 million to offer their ride-hail services to public agencies. The General Services Administration, which manages services for federal agencies, issued its final five-year award today. And General Motors will recall almost 6 million vehicles with potentially dangerous Takata airbag inflators after a U.S. safety agency said today it had rejected the Detroit automaker's petition to avoid a callback. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says the Takata airbag inflators are at risk of exploding under hot and humid conditions. GM has estimated that replacing the parts could cost $1.2 billion. I'm Don Kleppen, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
12:50, Wintrust Business Lunch. Amy Guth joins us. Amy, let's start with Guitar Center filing for bankruptcy. I thought maybe an instrument store like that nationwide and in Chicago would actually fare well during a pandemic, right?
You know, you would think, right? Because maybe people are going, well, time to buy that guitar I've always wanted. But
I thought everybody was going to take lessons or online lessons. We were going to learn to play the piano and guitar.
I know a few people who are. They're doing Old Town School folk music through Zoom, which sounds interesting, but maybe neighbors would have something to say about that. But nonetheless, Guitar Center has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and they're the latest that we've seen. You know, you and I have talked about so many companies that have been hit in the retail sector during all of this and all that's been going on. So they said in bankruptcy filing they got up to about $165 million in new equity investment. And lenders agreed to reduce the company's debt by nearly $800 million. So they weren't necessarily on the surest footing even before all this hit. And I think that's what we've seen with so many retailers, that maybe we're on a little bit precarious footing, and then the pandemic hit and really just accelerated some problems on their books.
Yeah, that was the case for some restaurants, too. Let's talk about what Foxconn is doing in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of discussion has been had about this place. It opened with great fanfare, the groundbreaking in 2018, and promising 13,000 jobs to Wisconsin. And, President Trump was part of that launch and really kind of hailed it as kind of the new Made in America center, that it was going to be all this. And then as time went on, they just weren't doing that. And it wasn't quite happening. That, you know, there's 13,000 jobs that they promised. They closed that year with about 178 hires, and so these large screen display panels they were going to make, they weren't necessarily churning out the volume that they promised, and they started making face masks and ventilators this year. So a lot, you know, and some of the subsidies had been pulled back, and some of the tax credits had been pulled back because they just hadn't, you know, done what they hadn't quite pulled off their plans. So their announcement comes is kind of interesting, and that is that they're going to make key parts for Google servers at this plant. And this is an interesting move for a couple of reasons. So Foxconn Tech Group is also, it's a Taiwanese company, and they are kind of pulling it there and putting it in this facility rather than creating this in Taiwan or rather than relying on a Chinese manufacturing base. They've really made a lot of moves to try to, I'm sorry, divest from China, but just kind of lighten their dependence on Chinese manufacturing. So I think that'll be interesting to watch to see if the timeline, you know, the milestones are hit and what that means for this place that at one point, you know, was such a promising beacon of this huge economic activity in Wisconsin, and it really didn't shake out that way. So it's interesting, too, for Google, because they feel that they, you know, want this stronghold in the Midwest where Microsoft and Amazon have kind of moved in and made a lot of inroads. So a really interesting thing to watch happening in Wisconsin there.
Really surprised to see how few jobs that is. 178. You're right. The number was a multiple of that. Let's talk about toilet paper. Well, I'll tell you what, not a show goes by anymore. I'm sure Anna feels the same way. You just get random texts and calls from people going, paper goods are wiped out. What happened? Where is everything?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Bloomberg did some really interesting reporting around this because they went and talked to executives from some of these big, manufacturers, Heinz, Kraft, here, and some other companies. They also, Walmart's chief executive, Doug McMillon, said in an earnings call, he specifically addressed this. You know, Walmart, one of the biggest retailers there, around. And he said that it really didn't have much to do with how people felt about what COVID numbers or what COVID numbers were actually doing in their community, but just kind of generally, we saw people doing, you know, throughout this, people were going to the store less often, but filling their cart more, kind of mirroring what happened in March.
Yeah.
But Doug McMillon said, you know, we're going to be able to respond a lot better because we've kind of been planning for the second wave, and that was echoed through a lot of other big retailers. Campbell Soup spent $40 million to expand just the production of Goldfish crackers. General Mills added 45 external production lines. So people really, I think companies really looked at what are people eating, what are they buying, what are they doing. Now, one area of industry that I thought was very interesting, the CEO of Chicago-based Green Thumb Industries, which is a cannabis company, he said consumer behavior was very different. He said whereas in paper goods and grocery pantry items, things like that, people tend to stock up for things that they would slowly use. He said, oh, people are stocking up all right, but they don't necessarily slowly go through it. You know, he said, you know, when people buy twice as much cannabis, they pretty much use it right up pretty quickly, which I thought was, very funny. But interesting to see how consumer behavior has impacted so many areas of business. But it seems like retailers are really, really trying to get out ahead this time. That said, the National Grocery Association leadership said, you know, we're probably going to start seeing some of those limits on purchases, like, hey, only buy two of these or things like that. He also advised that, you know, people should shop earlier in the day to make sure they can benefit from freshly stocked shelves before things get wiped out, but also really caution people to only take what they need and be mindful of other people in the community that, you know, just because you're going to eventually need 700 rolls of toilet paper doesn't mean you need to buy them today.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, this is just, we keep learning the same lessons or not learning them over and over again. And by the way, an observation about if you have more of it, you won't, you know, space out the use. You'll just use it twice as quickly because you got twice as much. That may be true for cannabis. You know that Jilly's jerky stuff that we have? It's a jerky. It's a beef jerky that's made here in Chicago. It's a mom and pop shop. They decided to go into this business. I ordered a bunch of that. I ordered like double the amount I would have ordered. And now I just can't stop eating that stuff. And I got an email from them, and I don't think they knew they were emailing me. And they said, due to the demand from the WGN radio interviews, we are going to be slow in getting our product out to you. Well, I finally got some of that stuff, and I opened up a packet, and I thought, I'll have this. And then I had another packet. stuff is really good. We got 60 seconds left. No, 30 seconds left. Just what is the headline on General Motors and the big recall?
Yeah, so they are recalling 7 million vehicles globally to replace airbags that are manufactured by Takata. So the best way is to go by a dealership or to go online. You can just Google the General Motors recall. It's mostly trucks and SUVs, and see if you have the kind of airbags that are potentially dangerous upon inflation.
Okay, good advice from Amy on General Motors products there. We'll visit again. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.